Okay, then last time I got into amphibian declines, hypotheses for amphibian declines, and how populations are doing globally. And we're on this hypothesis here, which is the influence of predators and competitors that have been introduced, so invasive introduced species. And for those who were not here, up on the top right, this is my ranking, which other folks may disagree with, other professionals or whatever. But this ranking, L is localized, and then they're ranked from 1 being severe and 3 being not as important, less severe. So this means local. It can have a localized effect and a marginal effect on a population. Usually it's certain species within a community that this has an issue on. Maybe those that are most susceptible to predation by an introduced organism. Okay, so the biggest thing with introduced organisms, the primary concern and the primary effect that we've documented is predator. Predation effects, okay? And this often occurs in areas where there were generally no predators, at least in the aquatic environment. All of a sudden you introduce some type of predatory species. So what do you think, what are some organisms you think might be predators on amphibians? Yeah, fish, right? And that's what that paper is about, introduce fish. And this is primarily, this has really occurred lots of places, but the biggest concerns with respect to documenting population declines to the point of extinctions have been documented, again, documented. This may be occurring in other places, species, but documented in the West, and primarily introduced species of trout, rainbow trout and brook trout. And so fish are eating everything, meaning that they're eating the eggs, they're eating the tadpoles, and then some are even eating the adults, okay? So they're very effective predators, and if you look in fishless environments, generally tadpole densities are much higher. Usually have more diverse community, but abundances are much higher of each of the species within that amphibian community. That's natural fish populations, and if you introduce them, again, they may not have those things. If it was a fishless environment, it's a bad thing because they don't even know what predators are. If they've evolved with fish, this new fish may have different types of things. At least as far as identifying and recognizing that fish as a predator. It may have different types of tactile abilities to predate organisms, and so that native amphibians are not used to. Anyway, so what we're talking about usually are sports fish or trout or different trouts that have been introduced, like brook trout and rainbow trout. Again, mostly in the West, this has been documented. Although rainbows and brook trout are not native to the Appalachians, right? Brook trout are. So rainbows, but rainbows have been introduced here in different areas, right? Okay. Do you have any rainbows? Maybe not. Just brown and brook. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all the three kind of main trout species, river trout species. So. Those can have a major effect. One of those species that it's been documented with is the mountain yellow-legged frog, which has a distribution in California. This frog is really not doing very well, and it's also been hit by the chytrid fungus, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So, anyways, read the paper that I handed out, and it talks about removal of fish populations and how it helps those amphibians, that particular species. Bullfrogs are another predator. They pretty much eat anything. They will eat eggs. They will eat tadpoles. And the tadpoles themselves, bullfrog tadpoles, will predate on eggs and smaller tadpoles. And the adults will eat anything. In fact, they will eat even small metamorphs. Well, and even adults of small species. So it says but adults, but that's not really true because they will eat adults of other species that are smaller. Here's another introduced organism, the fire ants. This has really only been looked at primarily in Texas. Now we're getting more and more fire ants in the southeast. In fact, they're out at Kuiker Bottoms Wildlife Management Area south of here. So there is concern about fire ants predating or in mass killing metamorphs. And that has been documented in some research in Texas where they just swarm them. You know, you think, well, it's an insect, right? So they can eat them, right? Well, that's all good, except when you get into a pile of them, they can't eat them all, and ultimately, next thing you know, the fire ants are carrying them off. Okay, competitors, again, we have fish or frogs. Well, fish could be competitors in some capacity, okay? Eating insects and things like that, the tadpoles may. More commonly, though, frogs, again, introducing frog species. In the United States, well, globally, the two main species are the cane frog or the marine toad. Cane toad or marine toad, which is Buffo marinus, and then our American bullfrog have been introduced, you know, globally, and have caused major problems in where they've been introduced, at least for some species. The cane toad is this big old sucker down here on the right-hand side. They're pretty efficient eaters. They're from Central and South America, and they are in Florida, and in other, I know they're also in Australia and other parts, you know, places around the world, and they are, again, just great competitors. One of the species I also mentioned to you a long time ago when we were talking about orientating towards other species calling and following them in and being potential predators on other species calling. These things will do that as well. Again, usually it needs to be a smaller species, but they're really good competitors. They produce something like 15 to 20,000 eggs, you know. Other introduced organisms, bait fish, various types of bait fish, mosquito fish, again, anything that's eating those small invertebrates, micro and macro invertebrates that tadpoles may depend on or salamanders may depend on. And then even crawfish, the release of crawfish from aquaculture facilities, etc. They can compete for various types of detrital food resources, etc., but also they'll predate eggs of anurans and salamanders. Introduced predators and predators. Questions on that? Okay. So that gives you an idea of the distribution of the American bullfrog. And native distribution going to the eastern United States, up into Canada, and over into the Great Plains state somewhat. And now they've been introduced throughout the southwest and western United States, having the greatest impact in California and especially the Sierra Nevada area. Of California. Okay. Next hypothesis, localized and generally not a major concern, but definitely have very localized impacts. And this is commercial exploitation. So going out and harvesting native frog populations for food or for the pet industry or even for research. So this is traditionally a concern in the Orient, although many of our biological supply companies, I've called them, they go out and they have permits. Usually all you need for many, at least quote-unquote common species, is a fishing license to go out and collect amphibians. In fact, that is the case within the state of Tennessee. And Pete was talking about it a little bit, is all you need is a fishing license to go out and collect amphibians that are not threatened or endangered. You can even go out and collect them and use them for fishing bait. But if you do that, you have to use them within the same watershed in which you collect. So it's not just restricted to the Orient, but traditionally. And here's some stats here. In Asia, around 200 million amphibians being exported annually from Asia, from India, around 70 million, and again, primarily for consumption and pet industry. Now, again, you might just think, well, that's just crazy, but we also hear some figures here. Country for the American bullfrog, we produce between 23 and 72 million tons of bullfrog legs annually, okay? And we're exporting American bullfrogs around the world. So there are monoculture facilities such as this one here, Ken's Fish Farm, down in Georgia, where we actually get a lot of our tadpoles from, that are producing lots of bullfrogs. Okay? Well, you know, I don't know if I've seen them in Tennessee. You definitely can get them down in Mississippi and Louisiana. I know you occasionally see them on menus at different places. I bet if you went to that seafood place there's some place where you can buy shellfish and all that. It's out. Somebody was telling me about. Where is it? Or was it? Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if they have frog legs because they get a lot of things like that. And they're good. Oh, I like bullfrogs. They're good, yeah. One other problem with this is releasing these organisms. So you may, even ronaculture facilities, they escape, etc., or people buy them. You can just get on the internet and type bullfrogs, and a bunch of places come up, and it says, buy bullfrogs for your pond. Yeah, you want to hear a bullfrog, so people buy them. Well, of course, they reproduce, right? So at least if you buy a male and a female. So that's where you know, a lot of the introductions also have occurred out west, is just ignorance, you know, from folks. And again, I don't mean that from a bad standpoint. Ignorance is just simply not knowing any better. And you know, actually, some people don't care anyways. But anyways. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I don't. There isn't very much difficulty in raising bullfrog tadpoles. Yeah, they just naturally can deal pretty poor quality and high densities. And the biggest bummer is that they usually take a year to develop. And so they feed the heck out of them to try to get them to go to metamorphosis, you know, as quick as they can. But usually you're talking 2 years to get them good size. So we have removal, and then, well, actually this is leading into release here with, you know, that happens with bullfrogs, but other rana species that people buy. Leopard frogs are one. I'm trying to think of other ones I've seen where you can buy them from biological supply companies. And for research, and you might get to the end of the study, and instead of euthanizing them all like you should do, folks will just release those tadpoles or those adults into an area where they shouldn't be. And even if it's a native species to your area, it's still not a good idea because of potential pathogens that they could be carrying from the lab that they picked up from other species. Difference in genetic structure, everything, okay? So usually this is a supply company or science-based institutions like universities or science classrooms, high schools. 9 million frogs are shipped annually, okay, in the United States. One of those frogs now, which pretty much exist, not in high densities, but all over the United States, is Xenopus laevis. Bottom left. They are great laboratory animals. They're totally aquatic. They're used, they've become the model organism for a lot of controlled studies on amphibians. The only problem is that in Africa, you know, so you release them here and, well, they can usually find a niche pretty easily. We don't have totally aquatic frogs in the United States. Okay, so you have problems when this happens with pathogens, genetics, changes in regional genetic structure. This is also ties into also, though, reintroductions. So species that have been declining and reintroducing species, raising species that are in decline, and then in the lab and then releasing them. Pathogens, again, that may be taken from the lab into the field and spread, and again, changes in genetic structure of the population. Okay, any questions with that? All right, some hypotheses related to indirect anthropogenic effects. So these are all direct things, right? You know, habitat destruction was on there. We're introducing, so just killing them directly. We're introducing different types of species that are eating things. I can't remember what else we had underneath there, but direct effects. Now we're talking about indirect effects. First is the global warming hypothesis. Which Alan Pounds is primarily an advocate of. We're talking W stands for widespread, okay? But it probably has, at least as of right now, our understanding, it probably has, it's having a low effect on amphibian populations outside of perhaps changing the distributions. Although some folks have claimed that some of the declines that we've seen in remote pristine areas is due to global warming. Well, that's debatable. Okay, so what's global warming, y'all? Right, y'all should know this by now, I guess. How's it caused? Everybody knows global warming's right, increasing of our Earth's temperature of our Earth's atmosphere, but how does that happen? That's something you should be able to explain to everybody, anybody. Because a lot of folks out there don't know, including our president. Don't know what it is.
Greenhouse gases build up and the sun's rays come down and instead of bouncing back out, they start
moving. That's right. That's right. Yeah, we're putting basically more molecules in the Earth's atmosphere, which results in re-reflection of solar radiation down into Earth's surface. Okay, so it's the anthropogenic increase of ambient temperatures by the accumulation of greenhouse gases. And compounds are carbon dioxide, N2O, nitrous oxide or nitrogen oxide, nitrous oxide, methane, CH4. Those are common greenhouse gases, and that kind of figure illustrates what Laura was just mentioning. Now, how does this, and what could be the consequences of the quote-unquote greenhouse effect? Well, primarily we're talking about, just like we're seeing, we are already seeing changes in species distributions, okay, globally. In fact, just get on the internet and type in, you know, changes in distributions, global warming, and there'll be a lot of information that comes up, not just on amphibians, but in fact, I don't know if there's been a whole lot with amphibians, but definitely changes in fish populations, distributions of fish populations. One thing that we have seen and has been documented in England are amphibians calling earlier than they have been before because it's warming up earlier. I don't know if that's a bad thing or a good thing, but at any rate, you can. One thing that we know and we're beginning to see, it's been predicted, now we're beginning to live it out, is the increase in the severity of weather going from very hot to very cold, and also very severe storms, such as we saw just a year or two ago with Katrina and Rita. Okay, so you have severity of winter. These, you know, can be issues. You know, catastrophic events. I think maybe Lori asked before about, you know, what are the effects of hurricanes. Well, there certainly could be an effect, especially in tropical areas like Puerto Rico and places like that, subtropical areas where they get direct hit from a hurricane, and you're dealing with canopy-dwelling species, highland species that require trees. There certainly can be major impacts on populations. For those that are more like ranids and stuff like that, you know, if it rains a lot, it probably is just okay. They just float around and they may be okay, unless there is correspondingly a decrease maybe in the prey population, insects and things like that from chemical runoff and stuff like that. It often occurs during hurricanes. But if we think about this down the road, and you know, I'm sure we'll probably begin to document some of this stuff. We are already seeing our polar ice caps melt. But it's hypothesized that some areas are going to get wetter and other areas are going to get drier. Areas that maybe are temperate will become more desert, etc. And that if you want real estate, go ahead and buy it now in Canada, because that's a good place probably in about, you know, 50 or 100 or 200 years to be. That'll become a nice temperate area like the United States. Okay. All right. So we're talking about, again, the severity of weather, changes in habitat, both from an altitude standpoint, a latitude standpoint. Species that are most likely to be affected by these things are your species that are more K-selected type species that have low reproductive rates, have very narrow niches, require specialized habitat requirements. Okay, so those are predictions. And really, again, from an amphibian standpoint, what have we documented? Primarily what we've documented are species in some regions of the world calling earlier. Any questions with that? All right. Next hypothesis is the UVB radiation hypothesis, first proposed by Annie Blostein, Oregon State. And again, this has to do with our ozone depletion. And the decrease in ozone has resulted in an increase in UVB radiation into our atmosphere, which can be an issue. Andy Blostein has led this research, and other folks have followed up on it. And they have documented several things, that atmospheric levels can result in direct mortality on eggs. It can result in a decrease in hatching success, and it can result in malformations at existing levels. It also, one of your readings is some recent research that he's just put out on even affecting metamorphs, juveniles. And a good thing about that paper that you have to read is it also summarizes pretty much all the research that has been done, because I think it was published in like 2006 or so. So the primary effect, though, that we believe is a decrease in hatching success on eggs. And that is primarily because for many anurans, their eggs are exposed directly to sunlight. They're either floating in a pond or they're attached maybe to vegetation that may be in receive UVB radiation directly. So what they have also documented is that the influences of UVB radiation are species specific. And it has a lot to do with the amount of photolyase in the eggs, which is an enzyme that helps repair DNA that's damaged by UVB radiation. Also, the life history of the of the species. So for those species that have eggs that float in a pond, for example, those have a greater chance of, or actually those, for those species, they are influenced by UVB radiation most negatively. In other words, they have the greatest decrease in hatching success. Also, organisms that reproduce at high elevation, as you go higher in elevation, the intensity of UVB radiation is greater. All right. So this is a global or a more widespread effect, of course, and there is solid research attaching it. That has been documented that this is a major issue, and unlike global warming so far, okay. So this is definitely having impacts on certain species. We don't know of any declines or anything associated with it, but in the lab it's been demonstrated. And actually, in mesocosm experiments, it's been demonstrated. Any questions with that? All right. Those species that lay their eggs in vegetation generally are affected least because the vegetation helps reflect the UVB radiation. Starting to put things, this box in here, you'll keep seeing this synergy. UVB radiation is one of the things that has been shown that can influence even behavior of tadpoles, etc. Which can ultimately act synergistically with something else. So an increase in UVB radiation may decrease mobility, which may increase the probability of predation, or it may actually influence the immune system, make them more susceptible to disease. So this is kind of one of the first things here to kind of bring up and talk about synergy, and we'll talk about it more with some of the other factors. Okay, acid rain hypothesis, widespread, probably not that big of an effect. Again, it has to do with really how acidic acid rain is, and when it gets into a water system and ultimately is diluted. So this is the anthropogenic decrease in pH, precipitation via the emissions of nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxide and their oxygen dissolution of acids. So y'all pretty much are probably familiar with the concept of acid rain. Okay, so we have various types of emissions that go up, nitrogen and sulfur emissions that go up into the atmosphere, and combined with water molecules create an aqueous acidic liquid that is rain that then ultimately falls onto the landscape. Okay, and you often see this, at least with our weather patterns, east of areas of localized emissions. Okay. All right, so the effects on amphibians, it's been documented that pH levels need to drop down to be pretty acidic, below 4, in order for it to really have much effect. And if you drop it below 4, you can see a lot of things. You can have direct mortality, and this is eggs and larvae. You can have delayed hatching. You can have reduced mobility of larvae, tadpoles, etc., resulting in an increase in their predation rate. And you could have reduced growth rate and size also at metamorphosis of larvae. Okay, so that's all been documented. How does pH influence amphibians, or specifically tadpoles? There are some effects when it gets very acidic. However, in most cases, we're not getting to that level, that much of an acidic level in in our aquatic systems, even in areas where there is acid rain. The one thing it can, though, and these go to the synergistic kind of subtle effects that are so hard to measure and understand, we can do this in the lab, is, well, there may be other things, like various types of aquatic invertebrates, microinvertebrates, macroinvertebrates that tadpoles, amphibians depend on, and those may be more sensitive to acidic levels. And so those organisms may decrease, ultimately decreasing the food source of for amphibians. And again, this whole synergistic thing, such as reducing mobility of tadpoles, making them more lethargic, etc., and increasing their probability of predation. Good? All right, the next, I think, four slides are the pathogen hypothesis, and I'll just talk about the major groups of pathogens that have been connected in some cases to declines. The chytrid fungus, I say localized because it starts local, but it's actually become a very widespread pathogen in areas, primarily in mountainous areas. Okay, Roberto Brenes will be here to talk in depth about it, but definitely, I want to say above 2,000 meters elevation, but he can give us a figure on that. So it's only in mountainous regions that we're seeing this. We're documenting chytrid. We've documented it at lower elevations, even in South Carolina. But for some reason, it doesn't seem to be pathogenic. I'll let Roberto talk about why or why not that may be the case. It only seems to be really pathogenic at high elevations. And it is most pathogenic. We've seen some declines with some of our mountainous species, such as the poor old mountain yellow-legged frog that also has problems with trout being introduced too. But it's primarily an issue in tropical regions, okay? Less of an issue in temperate regions. And again, Roberto has studied this pathogen for the past 4 years and specifically been on the front end of the southward progression of the chytrid fungus from Costa Rica down the Central Cordillera of Central America into Panama. And they got ahead of it and documented the populations of amphibians and tadpoles and various measures of primary productivity and aquatic insects and all this type of stuff. And then they waited for it to pass through and looked at the effects. So they're publishing all their stuff right now in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Nature, Science, all the big journals. Okay, chytrid fungus is in the phylum Chytridiomycota, hence chytrid fungus, and the disease is called Chytridiomycosis, and what it does is it seems to colonize around keratinized epidermal cells that have keratin in them. So keratinized epidermal cells, which are usually around the mouth in anurans and around the pelvic patch area. And when it colonizes in those areas, it can result in severe mortality. I mean, 50 to 100 mortality in a population. Gone. And it's, you know, Roberto will talk about how he's fought transects literally. I mean, this is the tropics, right? Hundreds of species, right? Just on a transect. And, you know, all over the place calling, chytrid moves through, and you're lucky to hear one. And if you're there, right there, there are bodies laying around. But, of course, in the tropics, things decompose quickly, and other things eat them and all that stuff. So they've been there. He'll have some personal reports for you. It does seem to affect the tadpole populations, again, because they primarily don't have much keratin, just in the, you know, the mouth parts, the beak portion. And it's when they go through metamorphosis, though the tadpoles themselves may act as a reservoir to keep chytrid around, although this thing just lives in the soil, etc. I mean, they're, again, this is one of those things that's happening so fast. 1998, they basically identified this. And it's happening so fast, we can't even figure out what's going on. And he'll have the most up-to-date ideas and hypotheses and what seems to be the most realistic reason for this rapid progression. What it ends up doing is it causes epidermal hyperplasia, or sloughing, basically causes sloughing of the skin. The skin cells die, they slough off, and it affects cutaneous respiration and osmoregulation, which ultimately end up killing the organism. And the biggest one is, you know, with the neurons, they could still have their lungs, but osmoregulation, being able to transfer different waste products across their skin, etc. And I don't think we even know what it's doing to salamander populations. Again, there aren't a whole lot of salamanders in the tropics or in very high alpine, well, areas out west. Currently, Dr. Rothermel is looking for chytrid in the Smoky Mountains salamander population. She hasn't found it yet. Okay. Now, whenever you see a pathogen, move that quickly. And it literally caused massive mortalities, high mortality rates, almost indiscriminately among all types of species. It's generally considered, in most cases, it's an introduced pathogen. And being introduced into a naive population that's never been exposed. So there are a lot of hypotheses. Where did this thing come from? How did it get there? You know, what were the mechanisms of transfer? Did humans introduce it? And there are different there are various hypotheses. One is Xenopus laevis, which can carry this thing and it doesn't affect it. The African clawed frog, but that's one hypothesis. We really, well, anyways, Roberto may have some ideas on that, but I mean, I'm sure he has opinions on it, because that group is, the whole chytrid group is very, definitely good thinkers, anyways, it's good debate to sit around with a bunch of those folks and hear what they hear their different thoughts, so. All right. Questions? Yeah, don't know. Don't know, I don't think. There are different hypotheses about, the thing is, don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different things. Is immune function different? That's one thing. Is it, you know, maybe it's interacting with other things like UVB radiation, it's decreasing immunity levels. There's other hypotheses that chytrid was introduced early 1900s and has moved through all of our populations, and that all these declines occurred in all these different species, and nobody ever noticed it in the early 1900s. And everything's resistant except those at very high elevations. And now we're just noticing it. Believe it or not, one of the top pathologists in the country believes that hypothesis. I know we weren't studying a whole lot of amphibians back then, but I think that some folks may have noticed that. So I don't know. We'll have to ask Roberto what he thinks. And he'll at least be able to lay out all the hypotheses. Okay. Any other questions?
Would it just need more oxygen? I mean, there's a lot of oxygen out there being pulled across the skin, the fall, and better oxygen at higher elevations.
I haven't heard that before. Let's see, greater oxygen levels, and maybe it makes it more pathogenic or something. That's a possibility. Folks have thought about temperature, but if that's the case, then, you know, in tropical areas, even in high elevations, it doesn't get as cold as it does in Tennessee, you know, during the winter, so that can't be it. And that this thing can live at a very wide range from like 5C all the way up to, you know, like 35C. So, yeah, I don't know. It does seem to be most effective. Well, I don't know. Anyways, I'm not sure. I'm going beyond my own knowledge. Yeah. All right, any other questions? All right. Here's the United States, or here's actually the globe. The red dots are showing where our wild populations, and this is real, real gross in general here, where we've experienced massive declines or documented massive declines. Again, out west, primarily in the California region, with a couple different species there. One of those is the yellow-legged frog. In Central America, again, in Costa Rica, about right in there, and progressing down into Panama, some areas of South America, Africa, Europe. The yellow ones are in captive populations, and Australia's experienced declines as well. Again, generally these are all associated with, I think they all are, I shouldn't say generally, they're all at high elevations, I believe. Here's a map of chytrid infections through the Sierra Nevada area of California, where red is the extinctions and current populations and chytrid outbreaks. This is for the mountain yellow-legged frog, again, that we've talked about, that's really not doing well. So. That's about it on that one. Okay. Radioviruses or iridoviruses. These viruses we're just starting to study these. The first declines, I mean, it's been this virus, this group of viruses has been isolated for a long time, at least probably 30 or 40 years. But the first declines were documented about the same time as chytrid, 97, mountain Arizona, in a salamander population. And chytrid has really taken the spotlight with respect to pathogens, so very few folks have studied iridioviruses. The ones that infect amphibians are in the genus Ranavirus, and there are lots of different types, species or types, and we're really not even, one is FV3, which is frog virus 3. That's very common in the anurans, and there are different types of frog virus 3. A lot of debate right now over the molecular structure of these things, but the one that is very common in salamanders is Ambisoma tigrinum virus, which is first isolated in the tiger salamander, Ambisoma tigrinum. It's called ATV instead of FV3, ATV for Ambisoma tigrinum virus, ATV. And declines have occurred, been documented in Costa Rica, United States, Australia. In fact, in the United States, this is the pathogen, the number one pathogen, okay? Pathogen associated with the most reported die-offs in the United States is with rhinoviruses, okay? Of all of the amphibian die-offs that have occurred and been reported to USGS, who keeps track of it, most of them, the majority of them, around 60% are associated with rhinoviruses, either ATV or FV3. This, in my opinion, although we haven't written a paper on it, we need more large-scale surveillance, but in my opinion, it's an endemic virus, endemic pathogen, meaning that it's here, and it's very widespread. And actually, rhinoviruses, fish can be infected with rhinoviruses. Maybe it may be a great source of rhinovirus infections. We're finding it in pretty much anything we test. When declines are most often observed, and this is common with endemic viruses, it is when the organism is stressed. So this is a concern because it interacts with anthropogenic land uses. For example, cattle land use. And I think Chandler presented some results to y'all about the increase in frog virus 3 prevalence in cattle access wetlands. Tadpoles, at least green frog tadpoles, inhabiting cattle access wetlands have a 3.9 times greater likelihood of being infected with FV3 than in non-access wetlands. That relationship doesn't exist for bullfrog tadpoles, so there's certainly some differences in species-specific differences. Okay, and that's where we are. I mean, we're on the edge of that knowledge right now. We're beginning to set up controlled experiments to try to understand it. But those are two common species, green frogs and bullfrogs, right? What about species that are less common, that are some of our tree frogs, etc., that are out there that we didn't even collect? This is where things become a concern from a conservation standpoint, because subtle or major changes in the environment that humans do can decrease the immunocompetence of less common species, and things that are out there that are always infecting things all of a sudden become pathogenic and result in mortality. This virus is awesome. It's a double-stranded DNA, and if you know a little bit about molecular biology, double-stranded DNA viruses are not often the most virulent, but they are the most environmentally resistant. This thing can sit out on that table right there for like 2 months and be fine. So it can be drying out of a wetland, etc. It's going to be there. All right. No way of treating a population for rhinoviruses. The best treatment is to reduce stress to a system. Okay. Well, what this thing does is ultimately it dissolves the organs, like many viruses do. Many viruses are hemorrhagic, and they often focus in on certain organs. This one is often the kidneys and the spleen, and it just dissolves those, results in hemorrhaging. And Dr. Miller will talk about specific pathological changes, so I won't get into that. But then an organ stops working, and then you die. So, okay. Any questions? Okay, another pathogen is a certain type of bacteria. It's gotten a lot of attention, although there's research now that has dismissed it as being more of a secondary cause of mortality. The particular bacteria is Aerosmonas hydrophila, which is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Okay, it's a very common bacteria that's found in freshwater and in saltwater, and lives around the organism, in the organism, all the time. Die-offs have been associated with a decrease in number of white blood cells and white blood cell counts. That's on the left side, WBC. Okay, so an organism gets stressed, white blood cells drop, and this pathogen can then result in some type of, pathogenic effect, maybe mortality. It's also been hypothesized, although we have not found evidence for it yet, that FE3 can infect an organism, start to cause pathological changes, and then Aerolimonas is the ultimate killer in the end. That's been hypothesized, but when we look at dual infections, there is no trend with respect to having an increase in this bacteria when organisms that are FE3 positive are, there's no trend that they're Aerolimonas positive as well. Okay, so that we haven't published that yet, but so anyways, but this thing, this particular bacteria actually can infect humans. If you get a cut, for example, fishermen often get infections by this, and you get Aerolimonas in a cut, it can become infected. If it's not treated actually relatively quickly, it can result in, you can lose a limb from it, okay? There's some pretty, you know, if you put this Aerolimonas hydrophila, put it in, you know, Google or something and say, fisherman, you'll have some, you get some weird pictures from different hospitals that'll come up. Yeah, if you ever get, you ever cut yourself in the environment and you start to swell up, go to the doctor immediately. Because it's serious. It is serious. I mean, if it's just a little reddening, no big deal. But I mean, an example is, I was waterfowl hunting once, and I cut my hand. Actually, a goose cut my hand. It was still alive. I don't mean to be gross or anything, but it cut me after we shot it. It cut me with its nail. And I don't know what got into me, but by the end of the hunting day, well, by noon, my hand was swollen up moderately. By the time we got home, it was like a grapefruit. And that's stuff that can kill you. I mean, if you don't go and deal with it right away. And I went in and, you know, to just our regular doctor at home, and he freaked out, you know. And, I mean, injected me with all these things and blah, blah, blah. And that is something serious that ever happens. Just kind of a side tangent thing. Okay, so, yeah, effects on humans. Gastroenteritis and septicemia, or blood poisoning. On amphibians, what this does, it causes the disease you may have heard of, red leg, and ultimately it causes capillary dilation and petrochial hemorrhaging, so hemorrhaging around the leg and pelvic region. And they'll stop eating and die from starvation or from septicemia, blood poisoning. Okay, so usually this is considered infecting secondarily to something else. Maybe viral or fungal infections or even something outside that's stressing that organism. But localized, maybe. Now, with our recent knowledge, I probably even dropped that probably. Well, anyway, L2 is probably a reasonable ranking for that. Okay, any questions? Chandler touched on this already, so I really won't get into it too much because we're going to talk about just a little bit more here in a second. And that is the trematode, Ribera-aurea. And the life cycle goes, I guess you can probably expect that now that you've gotten this from Chandler and I, you'll probably have to explain this life cycle. So if you didn't get it the first time, here it goes. You have some type of water bird, or mammals can also be the host, but with respect to amphibians, since water birds generally are in the water, right? You have the adult trematode worm, long tapeworm type things, flatworms that are up in the esophagus. They reproduce sexually, having a good time. They release their eggs, the fertilized eggs, the trematode eggs drop into the water through the feces. They hatch into myrisidium. Myrisidium then burrow, they're either ingested. Well, there are two things that can happen. The eggs themselves are ingested by the snail, or the myrisidium directly insists and burrow into the snail. Once in the snail, Those myristicidium reproduce asexually and transform into Sicaria. Sicaria burrow out of the snail and swim around. Like schistosomiasis, when you get swimmer's itch, except this is a different type of Sicaria. So it's a trematode that's out there, part of it, well, a trematode life cycle that's out there, burrows into you, and schistosomiasis burrows into, I'm not sure what the, I think it's fish, but it burrows into you as well, and you're not the host, so it dies, but it itches like crazy. Usually problems up in the Midwest. But for this one, the Sicaria burrows into tadpoles, and usually it, or it'll even swim up the vent, and it insists, it insists all over the place, but often it insists right near the developing limb buds, okay? And that's, you're the most effective Sicaria in your population, most intelligent Sicaria, if you're the one who actually gets around the limb bud. It takes more than one, though. It takes multiple ones. And they form a cyst, a metasicarial cyst, which then ultimately prevents development of that leg or splits the leg. And so then you have a malformed frog or metamorph, and it doesn't take very long for that thing to die or be eaten by something. And ultimately, you know, for the life cycle of the trematode, it needs to be eaten by that primary water bird host. If it gets eaten by a snake, well, no luck. A mammal will be okay. What's that?
Will you get partial credit on that question?
Partial credit? What do you mean partial?
It's going to be on the test.
Oh, it'll be on the test, yeah. Yeah, it'll definitely be on the test. So what can it do? Well, what do you mean, partial credit? Should I get full credit? If you missed it the second time, go back and listen to the podcast. Okay. All right, so then these things develop, they're malformed, they hop around, bad deals, okay? Now, is this causing decreases in populations? Obviously, that can affect their survival and reproduction. Again, localized, this has been in localized areas that this has been observed. And actually, hot spots for this have been associated with very eutrophied systems with cattle ponds. Many of the declines, a lot of the declines have been in Minnesota and in Wisconsin, and then a lot of declines out in the West in some western states, where they've seen the greatest malformation rates have been associated with cattle ponds, very eutrophied systems. And did Chandler talk about why that happens? Potentially. The eutrophication results in a change in the algal population, which results in an increase in the first intermediate host. That first intermediate host is this pond snail in the genus Helisoma. Okay? And it has to have a particular type of pond snail. So the planorbid snails, Planorbidae, Helisoma genus. Those increase in abundance. You have an increase in abundance, all you need is one little water bird infected to drop by and poop, and then you have a heck of a lot more of those Sicaria swimming around and infecting tadpoles. And that's been directly shown in controlled studies by Peter Johnson and Jonathan Chase. No. Not to my knowledge. You're not an effective parasite if you kill things. All right. Your whole goal is to keep that life cycle going. Yeah?
That also, is that occurring in migrating water birds that go to one species go like South America?
But, no.
Do we see it in other places other than
this particular trematode is associated with herons and egrets. So, herons and egrets?
Oh.
Not with, like, for example, waterfowl, no. And other, well, those are the only groups I've looked at. Oh, yeah. I'm sure there are, there are Helisoma snails, Panorbis snails, that are, you know, global. you know. But this particular species of trematodes just found in herons, which don't migrate too far. Okay, herons and egrets. All right, so mechanisms for known declines. Here are a bunch of them, even some other than what I talked about. This is recently been published, Global Amphibian Assessment. There's a link to them, and they have a great report that was published in 2006, talking about global amphibian declines and different causes, blah, blah, blah. Okay, red is threatened, blue is non-threatened. So when we look at things up there, what's the greatest cause? Number one cause for amphibian declines, threatened or non-threatened? Yeah, duh, right? Habitat lost, right? And when we look at, now this is number of species going across here. Now what's the next one? Let's look at red. Next big chunk of red here is pollution, then disease. I don't know, this whole fire thing. That's weird. I'm not sure what that's related to. If they're localized things or what's going on there, but I don't know where, I'd have to read the report on that one. Natural disasters here, like your hurricanes and stuff. Usually these are going to be dealing with insular systems. And again, they really can just get pulverized when a hurricane goes over them. Human disturbance is something that's not direct habitat loss, but you know, some type of stressor. Invasive species also important. But so the big things here that we're talking about are diseases, pollution, habitat loss, and invasive species, and fire or whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure where that is. I'll have to find out. I'll read that. That's pretty interesting. Okay, so just to kind of wrap things up there. And this comes back to the whole synergy thing, y'all, and that is that in most cases, it's not just going to be one of these. These things are going to be interlinked in some capacity, and that's what makes it very, very difficult to try to, you know, determine what's the reason, what's the cause. Everybody wants one cause, one answer. If it's multiple answers, we'll take multiple answers. Well, how in the hell do you create, the only way you do this stuff is through controlled experiments. How do you create a factorial experiment with all these things interacting? Well, hell, you can't even do that. You don't have the capabilities or the space to have any replication with an 8x8, you know, factorial experiment. You know, I mean, it's crazy. But things are being done right now with respect to starting to put these things together, looking at the effects of chemicals, for example, on increasing predation rates and multiple chemicals. Effects. Brand new coming out this year. Looking at things at sublethal levels, environmentally allowable levels of different pesticides together, working with different herbicides, with different nitrogen fertilizers, and how you put this mixture of junk that goes on to an agricultural field into an aquatic environment and what happens. Again, independently, they are all okay. EPA's like, yeah, you're golden. Right? And you put these things together and you create this concoction that is very lethal to amphibians. And so, in fact, a lot of that stuff hasn't even been published. We're just getting it, I'm hearing it and seeing the results at conferences. So a lot of these things are interacting together. And again, this is a young science, young field if you're interested in amphibians, because we have a lot to learn. And again, a lot of things and things that we're looking at are how do some of these things interact with just suppressing the immune system and increasing your probability of infection. All right, you lose one population, all right, who gives a damn, right? Well, that might be a big deal if you have a very small range, but even if you're a common species, one population, not a big deal. Two populations, maybe not a big deal. Three, but you remember when we started talking about that landscape effect, you start removing more of those populations, there's lower probability of interacting, has demographic effects and genetic effects. Again, to tie way back into the beginning of this lecture a week ago. And again, as I mentioned, this some factors increase in toxicity or virulence with other factors, and that's like that additive chemical effect I was just talking about. All right, amphibian malformations. Just kind of whip through these pretty quick. This, again, this is all recent stuff, y'all. 10 years ago, 12 years ago, amphibian malformations really were in the spotlight. And it was from discovery of a high school teacher, had a biology class out in Minnesota, and they were going up to a wildlife refuge, walking along a turn road that was bordered by corn and soybean fields, and these amphibians, these leopard frogs, are hopping along, and they're like, wow, one of the kids brings a malformed frog up, and then they're all looking at these frogs hopping around, and half of them are malformed. This is crazy, right? And so it started right then that made folks aware of, hey, something's going on, and all of a sudden reports around Minnesota, two-thirds of the county, 75 reports of malformed frogs when people started looking just within not even a year. So it really made some headlines and really scared people, etc. If you're a malformed frog, that's not a good deal. And let me tell you, 50% malformation rates is way, way, way high. natural malformation rates are around around 2%. Okay, 50% is a big deal. Well, the first thing that folks thought of, and so there were similar reports around, especially in Wisconsin. I don't know if you heard any of those, Jared, when you're up there, and also in the Western United States. You can imagine, these being around agricultural fields, the first thing was chemical hypothesis. So there are several hypotheses of why these may be occurring. We'll talk about one that's most likely. So these are malformation reports from around the country. I went to update this map, and it's down right now. So this is actually a map that I produced when I was in Texas, and I was talking about this. And at that time, I was doing research there, so I had a Texas map, and I wanted to have a Tennessee map. But we've had some reports. You can see, again, right in West Tennessee there. In Texas, there are a few counties out there, and we looked at malformation rates. Our malformation rate, again, we're right around what's expected for juveniles, around 1.5% and 3% for adults in that year. And it was the same for 2000. I guess this shows you how long ago I originally made this slide. But however, we had parasite loads, and that this paper we just published recently, and some of our tiger salamanders out there, barred tiger salamanders, up around 25%. It was a different species, though, than Ribariaria. It's a different species that is not known to cause malformations, although it may. So the question came, what is causing these malformations? Stanley Sessions at Hartwick College, it's a small college in New York, really spearheaded this research initially. And other folks followed up on it, such as Peter Johnson over at University of Colorado. And so the first thing is it's chemicals, right? Chemicals, right? There's a group of chemicals, a class of chemicals, the retinoids, which is a family of biochemicals that are important in embryonic development. And so the hypothesis was that basically you have an excess of retinoids out there which can function as a teratogen, which is anything that can cause a malformation, some type of chemical that causes a malformation, and in particular, methoprene is part of many of these chemicals. And methoprene is an insect growth regulator and prevents insects from developing, and ultimately, so it's an insect, part of an insecticide, prevents them from developing. So in excess, it can cause malformations. Well, Sessions' research documented that it's probably not the cause of these mass malformations because there's a lack of geographic, there's several reasons. There's a lack of geographic correlations where you have high concentrations of methoprene in the environment. You don't necessarily see a high number of malformations. Also, the exogenous levels of methoprene have to be very high, very, very high to cause malformations. So high that farmers are not putting it out at that level. There's no reason for them to put it out at that level. So it's not likely to cause. Plus, it the 2 days, it doesn't last in the environment very long. Also, it affects all organisms equally. So if we're seeing this in amphibians, we should be seeing things like this in fish and stuff like that, different types of weird oddities in fish as well. Also, it affects the limbs equally, both the front and the hind limbs. And usually the malformations that are seen widespread are with the hind limbs only. It causes symmetrical, the deformities it causes are symmetrical deformities. And again, I handed out last time this field guide for malformations just for your FYI stuff that talks about the different ones. This is, you don't need to commit that to memory by any means, but just, you know, that guide's out there. It's online. It's a great guide. But it creates symmetrical deformities like you see in that picture, and it creates bony triangles. So that's only basically two or three types of malformations. And there are 15 or so malformations that have been documented in this, and in the documentation of malformations across the United States. So not likely the case. Okay, so no. Well, he looked at UVB radiation. Okay, Andy Blaustein said, oh yeah, it could be UVB radiation. So, why not UVB? Okay, we know that UVB radiation can cause malformations. Well, it causes basically, again, just like four different types of malformations. And those malformations are not often the most common malformations that we see. Okay, so it's definitely, it may cause some, but it's not the cause of probably all these malformations that were being documented. All right, what else? What about the trematodes? We talked about trematodes. What about that? Well, Sessions and others documented that, yes, this is likely the cause. Why trematodes? Because it can create all the trematodes can cause all the malformations. And it happens to just be how those trematodes insist, where they insist and how they insist. And it's a random thing. So it creates all these crazy different types of malformations. These are just a few of them. There are four of them there, but again, they can create up to, you know, all the 15 ones and cause bony triangles and cutaneous fusions. And this has been demonstrated in the field and in the lab. Okay. So again, now how does this happen? Right there, you can see all these little trematode cysts, the metasecarial cyst here. Each one of these, okay, is a cyst, and you have to have a bunch of them really to completely stop them from developing. But if a few are there, it can result in split limbs like you see on the left. And there are two ways that they cause that malformation. They mechanically block the cells from reproducing, and they chemically inhibit the cells from reproducing or regenerating, whatever, replicating. All right. The fourth hypothesis is cannibalism or predation. Maybe that's causing it. Dave Fennig has spearheaded this stuff, and we've talked about Dave when we're talking about tadpole feeding ecology. But it's when you see malformations, you basically see asymmetric limb truncation. In other words, you see one limb gone usually. You know, and it's very easy to notice this, and if you look at it, you clear these things, you look underneath a scope, I mean, there's mechanical perturbation to the site, okay? I mean, you can see it's been torn or broken, or bones broken, whatever. So it only causes really just missing the ones that are associated with missing limbs, those types. In fact, this is not called a malformation. This is called an abnormality. USGS makes a distinction, okay? that this is an abnormality, not a malformation. A malformation is something that occurs during development that causes a deformity. An abnormality is something that occurs not because of it's affecting the development, okay? Like predation. This, for it also to occur, again, a lot of amphibians have amazing regenerative ability, especially as tadpoles. Salamanders do have a tremendous, just all the way through their life cycle, a tremendous regenerative ability. Urns less, but tadpoles do. In fact, if you tear a leg off early in development, a developing leg, it will regenerate very quickly. So we're talking about the pre-pro metamorphosis stages when they're growing a lot. Once you get into Gosner, now this is the bottom here. You'll see this is Xenopus. Xenopus, by the way, doesn't go by Gosner, and they just, you know, I don't know why. It's got to be confusing, right? But once you hit about 40 Gosner, you see a massive decrease in their capability to regenerate. So basically what you have to have is that predation event needs to occur right around 40 Gosner or later for an individual to, at least a tadpole, to go through metamorphosis and carry it as a metamorph. Of course, you have things that are out there in the terrestrial environment that can get a hold of leg as well, but a lot of time your terrestrial predators are, they get a hold of you, you're going to be completely consumed. All right. So, no. Let's see here. Well, I think what they said here is you can get a lot of different, now, yes, I don't know why. For some of them, I don't even know why I have yes up there. Definitely not the cause for all the. It's trematodes is the primary hypothesis. All of these can cause different types of malformations or abnormalities. But trematodes are the ones that are causing all these different varieties. Now, we still are trying to figure out what is causing an increase in trematode infection. Again, we've definitely documented, other folks have documented cattle areas as being hot spots, eutrophied areas as being hot spots. Actually, Chandler and Liz didn't find that in their tadpoles, but whatever. Okay. So. The last slide here is, should we give a damn? And this goes full circle at the beginning of the lecture with respect, should we care? And, you know, again, this comes back to what's been called the singularity of amphibians and them being an important indicator species. Okay, and there's lots of reasons. You know, they're good ecological indicators. They're important components of the ecosystem. Roberto will talk about how things change when your entire anuran community disappears. What happens trophically? Okay, major things. They can comprise massive amounts of biomass. In fact, that was a great stat. Who was here when that Pete said? The biomass of one genus of terrestrial salamander that you talked about in the Smokies exceeds the biomass of all the other vertebrates combined. Take all your black bears, take all the other organisms that are out there, and the biomass of that salamander exceeds them all. So these are important components of ecosystems from a primary productivity standpoint, a trophic structuring standpoint, etc. You remove those things are going to change. There are unknown medicinal uses that we've talked about, such as the gastric brood rearing frog, which is an obvious one that we could use for our own personal use. And again, the significant biomass. And this is another thing. Amphibians are long-lived. This ties back into, on average, around 10 years. This ties back into why they're good indicators. Again, they're sitting there. They're not going anywhere. They're being exposed to these things for a long period of time. So ultimately, you know, with indicator species, and this is hard for the public to understand, and even sometimes hard for us to understand as biologists, well, you know, if something at a lower level is experiencing these effects, it's only a matter of time before it affects us. Well, you know, we can just forget that and discount that and just say, well, that's not the case, you know, whatever. We'll just continue to think of things. We're brilliant, you know, which we are. We're too brilliant, unfortunately, because we're limited. We think that we can go beyond limits, and unless we figure out how to colonize other plants really soon, we're going to be in trouble. We're already in trouble. Okay. So what can you do? Again, y'all are familiar with TAMP, and you can become a TAMP volunteer and contribute, like last time we were talking about, contribute to the biological understanding of our population distributions. Your data go directly to TAMP, which goes to the North American Amphibian Monitoring Program, which goes to the Declining Amphibian Task Force. So you can be a part of that. Anybody can be a TAMP volunteer. Okay? And then amphibian malformations, this is a site here that you can, if you ever see an amphibian malformation, first of all, here's a little sheet right here, okay? And you can mark it and blah, blah, blah. If you, as a biologist, go ahead and collect it, put it in some ethanol, package it up, and send it to the Northern Prairie Wildlife Research Center here. But you can just go here and it'll tell you what to do. That's it, y'all. I know I went over, but thanks for sticking. Yeah, it's supposed to be malformed. Yeah, that's the whole idea of that one. Yeah, North Amphibian Reporting Center for North American Reporting Center for Amphibian Malformations.